My name's Stephen Neal, pastor at Alden Bethel Church and blogger at Building Jerusalem.
And my name's Stephen Watkinson, church planter in Rochdale and blogger at Northern Souls.
So one of the things in my experience in the Church of England was that although I think the Bible teaches about having multiple elders per congregation, often the direction it seemed to go in was multiple congregations per elder. But one of the reasons for that, I think, is around actually the process of raising up elders within a congregation, the process of appointing, the process of training, whatever it is, that we find that quite difficult to do. Why do we want to do it, first of all, and why do we find it difficult?
Well, why do we want to do it? It's easy, because that's what the Bible calls us to do.
So the kind of the pastoral seem to imply multiple elders per congregation sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, whenever Paul sent Titus off to appoint elders, he never said just get a bloke, you know, make him a pastor, and then you're sorted. It was always elders in the plural.
I mean, it's worth saying though, isn't it, that I think the evangelical church in its broad terms for quite a long time has sort of lost that and had a bit of a kind of, we just appoint a pastor.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and those sorts of churches have run into all sorts of problems. There's the accountability problem, that you get one guy running everything and there's no real check on anything he does before he does it. There's the problem that you disenfranchise your members. Your members very, very quickly learn, all right, the professionals do the job and we sit here and feed off of them. And when it comes down to a pastor's job and an elder's job, it is to equip the saints for works of ministry. But that very model works against that idea and basically says, no, I'm the guy who does the work and you just sit here and sort of benefit from my wisdom from the front.
And in the extreme, it's probably pushed towards, you know, all this stuff about burnout and great resignation. You know, if the pastor suddenly takes the responsibility for everything, then it becomes a more and more difficult job.
Yeah, it's unhelpful for the guy in the role. And it's unhelpful for the church. The biblical model seems to always be elder-led congregationalism, from what I can see. We may differ on that. You would kind of view that as a legitimate model.
Yeah. Well, I'm not the elder-led, but...
So you'd say elder-led is a vital aspect of church?
Yeah, I think so.
I actually don't quite view it that way. So I would say elders are more sort of the bene esse, I suppose. So you're saying they're good, and they're an essential good, but they're not part of the esse of a church.
Yeah,
In the early church, it's very clear, isn't it, that Paul sent someone to go and appoint elders in the churches.
Yeah,
the churches existed before there were elders, and so for me, having elders is important. It is something we are encouraged and commanded to do, but they're not part of the essence of a church. You can still have a true church without elders, even if it may not be a healthy and excellently functioning church. I think that's how I'd view it.
Yeah, I probably don't. I think, I mean, I agree that that's that. I don't think, I think the church should so the church is the gathered people. In that sense, congregational. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that congregationalism as a church government model necessarily is entailed from that. That's probably where we disagree. But I don't disagree on the kind of elders are then how it should, elders plural are then how it should ideally work out.
Yeah, I would say because the congregation is the SA of the church, then they must have done something somehow for when there were no elders.
Yeah.
And so if there's something somehow, that suggests that it's the congregation who are ruling, if you like, in the church at that point without elders. It seems to me the examples we have of when elders were appointed So we're not told exactly what Titus did. He was just sent off to appoint elders, whatever that means. The examples we have, though, of when people were actually chosen, it's quite clear they were sort of suggested by the leaders, and the whole congregation agreed to the principle. So
are you thinking kind of Antioch, Paul and Barnabas type stuff?
Not only there, but there are various examples in Acts about it. There are examples elsewhere of decision making being taken in the church where it was very clearly congregational, in the sense that, you know, a problem's arisen, we need to deal with it. Here are some people, and then the whole church is gathered. The idea is floated. And that idea may well have come from a member, it may well have come from the leaders, but the leaders then kind of affirm it, and then the whole assembly then agree with it. So it's not just the elders going, we're doing this.
Yeah.
You don't ever really see an example of that happening in the New Testament church.
Yeah, we're definitely want to go down our government view, but I can see how, I mean, it's interesting how you describe it, in that what you're saying is both a bit of top down and a bit of bottom up. And I think there might be multiple ways of expressing that. That space is what I'm saying. However, what we're looking at is multiple elders, and our concern, I mean, let me put it on the table as a church planter with a small congregation. How do you, a small congregation, and in a working class area, where a lot of what we think of in terms of what you need for leadership, we've maybe imported from all kinds of places that aren't the Bible, but how do you start to think about getting those multiple elders?
Yeah, it's difficult, I think. But you do have to start with the biblical qualifications, don't you? So I agree with you. We've often equated all sorts of things as being elder qualifications that aren't...
Go on, tell me some of those things, because I think it's useful to name and shame them to a degree, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think an awful lot of the time it's basically, if you're good at being middle class, then you're a good elder. And
so it's things like professionalism, maybe, or...
Yeah, well, certainly that's one example. So normally a guy, if they've done well in business and they know how to manage stuff, then they would make a great elder, because they'd be able to manage a church. Whereas actually the only management element you ever see in the eldership qualification is managing their household well. Mm-hmm. And that sort of management isn't about running spreadsheets. And it's not about...
Is that not how you manage your family?
No. And it's not about being the authority figure commanding your subordinates either. Because if you try that with your wife, you're going to struggle. It's about... sort of by managing your household, it's about seeing people's gifts, isn't it? Seeing people's ability to function, seeing what they're good at, what they're bad at, and then organizing things in such a way that everybody is serving your family for the good of its overall health.
And oddly, some of that stuff, do you know what I mean? If I say, we often look for people in leadership who've got quite a lot of front, a lot of kind of confidence. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, not a biblical criteria.
Yeah, but that's what we're looking for. You know, it's like the kind of, I can think of other contexts where I've been involved in appointing people and so on, and that's, they've looked for someone who had presence, which I can understand in particularly in those contexts. But it's the impressive person, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah, and you know, looking at sort of qualifications about your children, a lot of the time it's, do their kids sit still in church and look forward and seem to be taking in what's said, when actually I just don't think that's what the biblical criteria was driving at exactly.
To be honest, I'm not convinced I sit still in church. And but yeah. And so it's interesting just to put that dynamic in place, isn't it? Because one of the barriers to raising up elders is sometimes the set of criteria, even if we know they're not the criteria, but we kind of have them there anyway. So we know they're not the biblical criteria, but we'd actually quite like, this person with the confidence and the presence and the management capabilities and someone who's good with a spreadsheet or whatever.
I mean, it helps to know, doesn't it? I think Don Carson's been very helpful on it, where he says, if you look at the eldership criteria in the Bible, every single one of them, bar one, maybe one and a half, is demanded of absolutely everyone in the church. Mm. So none of the character things are not demanded of every member of your church. The only ones that aren't are not a novice, which, whilst it's not demanded, it's certainly no one's meant to stay there, are they?
No, but you can't help being there until you're not.
Yeah, but the idea is not that you remain a novice forever. Yeah. You know, eventually you grow up. So that one is sort of the half. The one that's not demanded of everyone is able to teach, which is an ability, not a character criteria. Everything else is character based and commanded of every single believer. So what you're really looking for, in essence, is a godly bloke who can teach the Bible a bit.
Yeah,
that's it. And it's not even asking for a good preacher, which again we read able to teach as brilliant preacher from the front. That's not what it demands. It's asking for a godly teacher of the Bible, and even
so, sound, faithful, able.
Yeah, and even then I would distill it down a bit more than that, because it's not saying, even outside of the pulpit then, oh well, they, you know, they're really great at explaining everything the Bible says in every other context outside of the pulpit. It's not even saying that. What it's really saying is, when people come along with heresy and false teaching, they're able to at least spot it and say, that's not right, and I can show you why that's not right. That's what it means. And by able to teach, it's talking about teaching by example in character, teaching from the Bible, what is and isn't ultimately true, even if, you know, because all of it, you know, the very best preachers in the world will occasionally make missteps. It's not saying it's able to teach and understand absolutely everything perfectly. It's saying, look, do they essentially know good doctrine, and can they guard the church against false doctrine? That's what it's asking. And there's multiple ways you can teach, and there's multiple ways you can guard solid doctrine without necessarily being a brilliant small group leader or preacher in the church.
See, putting those things in place should, I suppose what we're saying, broaden the field, hopefully.
Yes.
Because if we've overlaid our cultural things or whatever it is about what we... I mean, it always used to make me... I mean, people used to do spoof adverts, didn't they, for kind of church positions. But I know when looking for positions, when I was doing that in the church, I mean, it just made you laugh. You know, they wanted... you know, it was quite clear for us. It was really common that people wanted a guy with a... You know, a youngish guy with a family. And you're kind of, well, where's that?
But I don't know. Maybe they didn't want Jesus to apply for the
role.
I know.
Well, But you've chucked all that stuff out of the window, hopefully. So you've broadened the field.
You say that Jesus probably was all right at business because he did a bit of carpentry before he went into his stuff. So actually, maybe they're onto something. I don't know.
But you've broadened the field, and I mean, I guess you're then kind of going, so what then stops churches, maybe specifically in our situations? I mean, maybe still we don't feel we've got lots of people in that place.
I think there's something that floats around, that the eldership criteria are not exhaustive. So, and that's observably true. So, for example, there is nothing in the Bible that says your elder must be able to speak English. But if you're in England, it's not an unreasonable thing to say, you know, speaks English. So in that sense, it's not an exhaustive list of what you're looking for. However, I would argue, because I've heard people say that before, as in, there you go, there are other criteria there then. I would say, actually, no, that is a subset, isn't it, of able to teach. If you can't speak the language of the people you're talking to, then you aren't able to teach in that context. And that therefore means you aren't able to teach. Whereas if you can speak the language, chances are you can. So I don't actually see it as a separate criteria. So you sometimes have that floating around.
Yeah.
It's not an exhaustive list. It's just indicative. Or it's, that's your bottom line qualification, but there are other things. I think we're just risk averse. So we are desperate to have people who we just don't think will stuff stuff up. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's, in many ways, that's a sensible concern. But we want people who won't stuff stuff up. But then our calculation for the people who won't stuff stuff up is that they're the people who are good at X, Y, and Z that aren't necessarily the criteria. And the actual character things that are listed often get sort of overlooked or that. And then third, yeah. I think it's important to note that they're all quite subjective, really. I mean, you know, how able to teach do you have to be? And what does not quarrelsome look like? You know, for some people, not quarrelsome means you never, ever have a discussion with anyone about anything and disagree with them. For other people, you know, you could be going, you know, like hammer and tongs at somebody and they're like, no, it's fine. You know,
that's just a healthy discussion.
Another person raises their voice. Are they angry or not? I mean, a lot of them are quite subjective. And you think, you know, and then... inevitably they get filtered through your culture and through your through your own, not just your wider country's culture or your class culture, but also through your family culture and through your church culture and through your local culture and through your own personality. And all of those things are kind of filtering out, I guess, people. You go, oh, well, they're like that, and that to me is like this, which is part of the reason why you want a plural eldership and why I believe you take the decision to the local church as a whole, because you're much less likely to get that sort of very, very tight understanding.
Well, it's perhaps also not being risk averse enough the other way. Say, the idea of not having plural elders because you can't find them, because you can't find the right person to be written, because you're being risk averse, is also pretty risky. So, I mean, we've had enough stories, haven't we, of kind of one man bands that have been, you know, problematic. And we need some, we need to grasp it from both directions, that it is fair enough. I mean, I can understand that. I think you can sort of imagine someone who you could kind of go, I can't just put my finger on it, but I'm not sure I want this person in the position, sort of thing. But also going the other way of going, but if we don't, there are real risks in not having some plurality here, because, you know, I mean, you just have to look at yourself, don't you, as someone who is kind of, I mean, I'm not a one-man band in one sense because I've got some people over me and that kind of thing. But you can totally see how you just go, well, I think we need to do this. So let's do this. And then suddenly everything becomes, well, I think we need to do this. So let's do this. And you can totally see how even a godly guy can quickly go off the rails without that kind of...
Well, you can be godly and stupid, can't you?
Oh, well, and regularly.
You know, one of the qualifications for eldership, sadly, is not an idiot. which is good, because that would rule out quite a lot of us. But the if you are an idiot, and we all are idiots, because I don't think there's many of us who look back on ourselves from 10 years ago and go, oh, sorry, bit of an idiot, you know, we all do that.
Yeah.
And if we all do that about ourselves last year and 5 years ago and 10 years ago, the idea we're not going to be doing that in 10 years time. So we're all idiots.
Well, and we all know, I mean, even look back 6 months ago, that was a stupid decision.
Yeah. And the point is, you can be a thoroughly godly bloke who's doing your level best to be faithful to the Lord and still make stupid decisions. And that's why you want people on an eldership who are different to you. And you know, I get really disappointed when people will only seem to serve on an eldership, or they only ever want to run an eldership with people who are just like them. I think sometimes we dress it up in more spiritual sounding language. Mm. So sometimes we dress it up as sort of philosophy of ministry stuff. Just means you do stuff differently to me. You have a different idea of how things should operate to me, and they use that as a means not to serve with other people. I just think, you know, the whole point of having people who are different to you think differently to you. Of course, there are some major things you need agreement. So you need to agree on the gospel, and you need to agree on the sort of secondary but important matters of your local church. But beyond those things, you know, if you meet the eldership criteria, I do not understand this idea that you'd want people just like you, because if you're prone to make stupid decisions, and we're all prone to make stupid decisions, if you're all the same kind of person, you're that much more likely to do something stupid because you don't have anybody else from a different perspective going, do you know what? That's not going to work.
Well, I guess it kind of comes from a desire for an easy life, doesn't it? So if we all basically think the same about it, then meetings will be easy and we'll all be jolly good fun and all that kind of stuff. And I get that to a degree, and that's the temptation, basically, isn't it?
That's why
you don't want to do it.
And that's why one of the qualifications is not quarrelsome, because there is a difference between a guy going, look, I don't think that's right, and I'm going to, you know, I'm really going to push hard on this. But then, you know, they get overruled by their elders and they go, you know, okay, fine. Whereas if you're just the sort of person who only ever picks fights all the time just for the sake of it, well, that's the difference, isn't it?
And it's one of the learning things, I think, isn't it? So there's a difference between disagreeing with an idea, plan, whatever it is, and disagreeing with the person. And I think one of the quarrelsome things is basically, I just don't get on with this person and I'm going to disagree with everything they ever say.
Yep.
Whereas that kind of humility to come into an eldership, whichever context that is in, and go, we're all, you know, people who've been set aside to be elders of this church, and therefore I might be wrong, they might be wrong, and we discuss it at that level. And, you know, so trying to, I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it? So some of those character things we'd have to think quite, you know, so someone might be super sound and able, brilliant teacher, and they might, by and large, have very good character, but could be totally destructive to an eldership if basically it was all really about they were quarrelsome, they were shaping it in their own image, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, because it's a subjective set of measures, it's very easy to read in what you want to read in. Which again is why I think it's important to have more people involved in the decision making capacity.
Well, it's striking, isn't it, that one of the, I mean, it's, you see it go wrong in a couple of ways, don't you? See, broadly, it is true that when you put people who aren't sound teachers and can't spot doctrine there as into leadership position, I mean, that's your recipe for your church going off the rails theologically. But if you put people without sound character in place, that's your recipe for the church to go off the rails, just as a family, as a community, because you just get divisions and breaking down because the character's broken.
Yeah, and you know, there is some wisdom you want to apply, isn't there? Because if you know, look, we're just going to be arguing all the time, you know. So for example, in my church, you got a pedo Baptist onto your eldership, and you know we're just going to be constantly fighting all the time about should we allow this person into membership or not. I'm always going to be saying no if they won't get baptized, and they're always going to be going yes because I think they have been baptized. You know, now, you know, whilst none of that is an eldership criteria, it's a significantly serious issue that you know is going to come up all the time, to mean that the chances of you actually achieving anything, because you're constantly going to be arguing about that, means that it's just not a sensible choice, isn't it? So you do have to apply a bit of wisdom and prudence.
I suppose the wisdom there is, look, if this is what we stand for as a church,
yeah,
don't come onto the eldership standing for something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question you would ask of any prospective elder is, do you submit to the teaching of the church and its existing practices? Are you on board with those things?
It's interesting. Again, this is my background, but one of the things that's deeply frustrating in the Church of England is you look at what the Church of England stands for. You've got all these people who come in, right, and are elders, if you like, in the church, who don't stand for that, and therefore they spend the entire time changing the church into what they want it to be. And therefore, you know, I mean, I would always have sat there and said, you know, the most frustrating thing is to sit there believing what the church stands for and be ostracized in your own church for believing that. Mm. I mean, church in the denominational sense there. But And that it's therefore foolish, I think, in a local church to put someone in who just doesn't stand for what the church stands for.
Right. So I think on those sorts of things, there's
wisdom.
Yeah, it's prudential. But I think ultimately, if you've got someone who believes in the core beliefs of the church, the doctrinal basis, they believe in the fundamental practices of the church as they are, they're able to teach on some level, you know, I think having people who are different to you is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because then they will offer a different perspective. But they also need to be the kind of people who, if four out of five of you are saying one thing and they're saying something different, are willing to say,
okay,
that's fine. I can go with that. And equally, you want all of your elders to be able to do that. It doesn't mean that they won't fight hard for their position. I mean, that's how I view it. So, you know, some people think I argue quite forcefully for whatever position I've got, and that's ultimately because I believe it. But what I would do in an elders meeting is I would argue forcefully for my position. I would expect the other elders, if they disagreed, to argue forcefully for theirs. And you know, when it boils down to it, I would say, look, let's take a vote, or you know, work out where we all stand. And if three out of four are saying to me, look, we think you're wrong and we disagree, that's when I would go,
okay. I've argued for it, and that's
I've made my case. We disagree. I believe in plural eldership, and therefore, you know, whether I agree or not, this is the elders' now determined position. That is therefore my position. That's how it goes.
And there's something there in character as well, isn't there? Because so the alternative to that is you do that, and it's 3-1 or whatever you were saying, and you then go, well, I'm going to argue it through the church or something like that and try and cause division, or I'm just going to resign. So every time I lose an argument, I'm going to resign.
Well, to be fair, if you did resign, then that resolves that problem anyway.
Well, it does.
Then you don't argue anymore.
It does, but there is a sense in which you've got to go into eldership knowing that sometimes you'll lose the argument and you have to be willing. You know, obviously there are cases where you might feel you had to resign.
Well, yeah, but you may say, look, I don't know, I've got some fundamental disagreement on something or other. The elders all disagree with me. And for me, it's a matter of conscience. And saying, look, I cannot in conscience do that. Now, even there are some things. So, you know, I was somewhere recently, and this is a particular Baptist issue, I should add. But
there are a lot of them.
Yeah, that's right. There are lots of them. But the particular issue was at what age do you baptize children? So that's something that does the rounds. Now, one guy in the church believed that it should really be when they're independent of their parents, whatever that looks like. Whereas the rest of the elders were of the view, you know, actually, no, we'd be happy and comfortable with a much younger age of baptism. I don't know where they drew the line, but younger than this other guy was comfortable with. What he said then was not, well, it's a matter of conscience for me, so I'm resigning. He said, it's a matter of conscience for me. I cannot in good conscience put my hand up to vote in favour of someone who's 10 being baptised, in his view. Therefore, what I will do is I will just abstain on any vote of that, but I won't stop the elders doing what they think. Yeah. So there are ways around conscience issues where you can say, look, I'm not voting in favour of this, but I am still submitting to the eldership. And then there are other issues where you go, this is so serious, I can't even serve as an elder and be associated with this. But as I say, you draw the lines and you use wisdom about what those things are, don't you?
Yeah, and you just have to broadly have the attitude of thought that 90% of what you're going to be talking about or more shouldn't be a resigning issue.
Yes.
And if it is, I mean, we all know people who it's the other way around. 90% of stuff is a resigning, you know, it's just that everything is.
Well, I'm afraid that's what we have in the church broadly and what we've created. And I think many of our leaders we're creating like this, which is basically, if I don't get my own way, I have a little moody about it. And it's becomes a resigning matter. And, you know, they could be serious issues. And so sometimes it looks godly when actually we're not really. It's just I haven't got my own way. And other times they're not resigning issues, so it doesn't even look godly. But we're just going, I want it this way. This is frustrating because I haven't got my own way. I find it too hard to submit to people doing things that aren't the way I would do it. Therefore, I'm off.
And I mean, interestingly, loads of this stuff comes back to discipleship of people, doesn't it? In terms of, if one of the reasons we might go, oh, it's a real struggle to get elders, is what we're really saying is we haven't got many godly men in the church. And the reason we haven't got many godly men in the church is because we haven't reached and discipled many men. And actually, I think you see it within a lot of leadership. And I think a lot of the problems that we seem to be going through in terms of leadership is you kind of want to go, well, that just feels like you haven't got a godly man in leadership there, in eldership there. You know, that isn't a godly response. That isn't, you know, and I don't care how brilliant they are as a preacher or what a fantastic theologian they are, whatever it is, they just don't seem to be a godly person. And that's a discipleship failure.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, therefore, I suppose the key to raising up leaders, and this is something any church can do, whether you're small or big or whatever, is to disciple your people well. If they are well discipled and they are serving in other ministries of the church, you see how they interact with people and function with people, actually you get a measure of their godliness. And I think 9 times out of 10 you see godliness worked out, don't you, when people disagree with someone, when they don't get their own way, and how they respond to that. And yeah, I think the reason we often struggle to find elders is there's not always a lot of people around who don't stamp their feet.